I had inner permission to write the memoir and to work through the contradictions and work through the difficulties that I might have and not have a Greek chorus in my head telling me, you can't do this.
Welcome to the IPA podcast, Psychoanalysis on and off the couch. This is a podcast in which we will discover the world of psychoanalysis that lives beyond the couch, beyond the individual consultation room. We will meet psychoanalysts who work in dialysis units, prenatal clinics, corporate boardrooms, community centers, humanitarian organizations, and with vineyard workers, just to name a few. We hope these conversations expand our awareness of how broadly psychoanalytic thinking extends into our communities. Come listen, enjoy, and please share your comments on the webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org. Hi, welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest today is Susan Mailer. Susan Mailer is American-born, grew up in Mexico, and has lived in Chile for more than 30 years. In the late 1980s and early 90s, she trained at the Chilean Psychoanalytic Institute, becoming a full member a few years later, as well as an active faculty member of the institute. She has published widely in Latin American psychoanalytic journals and in psychoanalytic dialogues, and she has participated in numerous psychoanalytic panels and conferences worldwide, including the Winnicott Congress, IPA Congress, congresses associated with FIPAL. She teaches, supervises, and has a private practice in Santiago, and recently co-founded the new IPA-affiliated Psychoanalytic Institute of Santiago, and is working on the development of its institute. Her memoir, which will be the focus of our conversation today, is entitled In Another Place, With and Without My Father, Norman Mailer, and was recently published in 2019. Our conversation today is wide-ranging. We covered the meaning of celebrity, its impact on others and herself, how celebrity in writing a memoir lives and impacts the clinical setting, what psychoanalysis has been like under a dictatorship, and her own personal journey in becoming a psychoanalyst. With great pleasure, here is my conversation with Susan Mailer. Susan, welcome to the podcast. It's a pleasure to have you on board.
Thank you, Harvey. It's a pleasure for me, too. I'm very happy you invited me to be on this conversation, on this podcast.
I'd like to begin with a bit of transparency on my part. When I learned about your availability and your acceptance of my invitation to appear on this podcast, I had a feeling of excitement. And it wasn't difficult for me to listen to that feeling and recognize that it was in relation to your celebrity. And your celebrity is a bit unusual because it's via your last name and your being the daughter of the famous writer Norman Mailer. And it occurred to me that my reaction likely wasn't terribly unique and that many people meeting you will bring all kinds of imaginings and affects and excitements before they even get to know you, the person. And that reaction of others over the course of your life, I imagined, was some mixture of pleasure and burden. And then I had the pleasure of reading your memoir, which I recommend to our listeners. It's called In Another Place, With and Without My Father, Norman Mailer. And I learned, not surprisingly, that you're well aware of the reaction that your particular version of celebrity evokes in people, and that over the course of your lifetime, you have, both from others and inside yourself, had a mixture of pleasure and burden with it. That all being said, it also occurred to me that a psychoanalyst who writes a memoir is in some way a contradiction in terms. And by that, I mean that one of the instruments of our work is to introduce carefully titrated personal anonymity for the purpose of introducing our analysands to the freedoms in their imagination, when their imagination is freed from the burdens of mere reality. And you've introduced, obviously, a lot of reality about you to them. So that leads, and I'm saying, obviously, nothing that you don't know, but it does lead to the question of how you thought about that when you were deciding to both write the memoir and what you did or didn't include in the memoir. And even more, what you've done really for yourself and the field is you've run a sort of natural experiment. You've sort of challenged an assumption of our theory, which is that there's a limitation that you engender in the analytic space when you fill it with so much information. Well, that's the theory, but you've actually run the experiment, and you can help us learn about what impact it has had on your patients, on the analytic space you were able to create to them, and on the outcome of your work with them. Not to mention its impact on your colleagues, which I imagine also was something that that's something that you thought about. This is all my long welcome to the podcast. And with that as the welcome, let me turn it over to you and invite you to reflect on these thoughts and others as they occur to you.
Okay. Well, I've thought about this. I think it's important for our listeners to know that I didn't take this lightly. Writing a memoir was not something that I took lightly. I thought about it for a long time. The writing of the memoir was something that happened to me. It wasn't something that I decided to do, that I set out to do. I was invited to give a keynote speech at the Norman Mailer Society conference in 2013. My father had died in 2007, and when he died, I felt a kind of liberation that I didn't quite know what it meant, but I just felt like a weight had been lifted from my shoulders. And I think it had to do with fame, with his fame. When he died, there was a memorial at Carnegie Hall. 2,500 people appeared, which was an amazing surprise to me. It was an incredible event. And all of his nine children, my Aunt Barbara, his sister, and a cousin of my cousin Peter, her son, and another cousin, we all stood up on stage with his face in the background. There was a huge poster of him with a sailor's cap. There was a very famous photograph of him, and that was always the backdrop of the whole Carnegie Hall event. And so there we were, sitting like the Von Trapp family, in chairs, and each one of us got up in order of age and said something about our father or brother. You know, my aunt talked about her brother in order of age, and not more than 3 minutes, 4 minutes, at most 5 minutes. And it was the first time I realized, it was the first time that he was in the background and we were in the foreground. We were up front there in front of all the audience. And they were riveted. Later I read in the New York Times that it was the best moment of the evening, even though there were many other famous people there. So it was my claim to fame, my own claim to fame at that moment.
Right.
And then 7 years later, or 6 years later, I was invited to give the keynote speech at the Norman Mailer Society conference. And I went down memory lane and I thought about the years when I lived in Mexico when I was a little girl. And my father used to go to Mexico every year and spend 3 months there with his wife, Adele, and take me to the bullfight. And I thought, well, that's something that no one really knows about. That's a side of Norman that people don't know, not the people who study him, all the scholars, professors, et cetera. They don't know that about him. They know that he liked bullfights, but they don't know what it was like for me to go to a bullfight with him. So I wrote the piece. I enjoyed writing it very much. And I thought, I want to do more of this. I want to write a few vignettes. Maybe I can turn them into a book, maybe not, but I'd like to write more about him and me and the family. But it was basically about the two of us. And so I embarked on this journey of writing vignettes and realized at a certain point that if I wanted to turn these vignettes into a book, I needed help. And I got help from Kaylee Jones, James Jones' daughter, another daughter of a famous man, a famous writer, the same generation as my father and also a friend of my father's. And she's a writer and she's a memoirist also. And she helped me through this. So the whole journey took 4 to 5 years. And during those years, I wrote the first draft in the first year, but then it took me another 3 years to rewrite the book over and over and over again, and then another year to have it to publish it. So I had a long time to think about how this was going to impact my patients. I went through a lot of soul searching. I thought, am I doing something that's going to be bad for my patients? Am I doing something that is am I doing something that's going to be bad for my what are my colleagues going to say? What about my prestige? What about, you know, what's going to happen when this book comes out? And I battled through that with that for years. And I had the time to do it. Now, I have, as an aside, and I think this is a very important aside, is that I live in Chile, and I work in Chile, and all my patients are Chileans, except for maybe a few Americans. I've had, in my 25 years here as an analyst, I've had maybe 10 American patients, and all the rest have been Chileans. And the Chilean patients that I have, maybe they speak English. Some of them do. Some of them have been in the States. But most of them are Spanish-speaking and not English, and they don't read English. And they certainly don't read English novels or memoirs. They don't even know what a memoir is, okay? Because it's not a form of writing that is very popular here in South America. So I had that to shield me. That was a protection. And it still is a protection because I think only one of my patients has read the book, and he's a writer. I don't know what his reaction was because he started reading the book before he went on vacation. And because February here, the end of January and February is vacation time here in Chile. He bought the book. He had it there for about 2 weeks. He wasn't able to open it. And finally he said, I'm going to start reading it. And I will tell you how I feel about it once I've started reading it, because we talked about it. And he said, I heard you wrote a memoir. I said, yes, I did. He said, well, do you think I would like to read it? And I said, I think we should talk about it before you read it. You have to be aware that this is not a novel. It's a memoir. And I explained to him what a memoir was. He knew, of course. I said, so when you read it, you're going to know a lot of things about me that you don't know. And I think it's a decision that you have to make whether you want to know these things about me or you would rather not know them. So he said, well, we can talk about it. We did. He went back and forth. I think in the end, he decided he wanted to read it. He wanted to buy it and he wanted to read it because he wanted to find out if I was a good writer. I think that was one of his main aims in buying it. And then something very odd happened. He told me, he had some comments on the writing. He said he thought it was well written, that the first chapter was well structured, and then he went silent. I tried to listen to the other, you know, to what if he was alluding to the book without mentioning it, but he was very concerned about his relationship at that moment, and it seemed to me that he was on another track and very worried about how his marriage was going to work out. So at that point he left on vacation and I don't know what's going to happen.
And it's always tricky at those moments, whether his worry about how his marriage was going to work out was A, simply about the marriage, or also worried about the impact of the book, about how his analysis is going to work out. And how to tease those apart is always challenging.
It is very challenging, especially when they're going away.
Yeah, then it's doubly challenging. Yes, indeed. Right.
It was doubly challenging in that sense. So that's about the only example I can give you with my patients, but I have thought about it. I've thought about self-disclosure very much, and I think that, and about neutrality and about anonymity. And I think I should start by saying that I grew up with a father who was not anonymous, obviously, and who cherished his fame. And he also was a master of self-disclosure. Everybody knew about his life and what he did and what he didn't do. So I always had a struggle with privacy and self-disclosure. I had my own struggle with that. And when I became, when I went into analytic training here in Chile in the 1980s, the training that I got was basically Kleinian, and it was a pretty classical. And so the privacy of the analyst, the neutrality of the analyst was something that was very much stressed. And to me, it felt like a straitjacket, because I believed, and I still do, that there is no such thing as neutrality, that the way that you walk, the way you dress, the way you speak, the way your office is fixed.
Let me just draw a sharp line about something. Maybe it's a little bit of a bugaboo of mine. Neutrality and abstinence are often conflated, and I think what you're referring to is abstinence. Neutrality, I understand anyway, as a state of mind which leaves you equidistant as you immerse yourself in the patient's inner experience. So neutrality is really in your mind, but the what you're referring to is abstinence, about hiding yourself or revealing yourself. Mm-hmm. I didn't mean to interrupt your flow of thinking. It's just, it's a point that often people struggle with, and I'm hearing you about abstinence. That's why I introduced it at the beginning with carefully titrated, because I think absolute notions are problematic because they're absolute. And I think that's what you're saying as well.
That is what I'm saying. But I also feel that abstinence might be an ideal, but I don't think it's possible, because even though we are putting ourselves in parentheses and listening to our patients, putting ourselves in parentheses is up. You can do it up to a certain point, because you are, sure. You react to a lot of the things that the patient is saying, and you also have your own thoughts. I mean, read Ogden, and you read about Reverie, Beyond, and also about mutuality, and how it's, you know, two minds working together, two people together in a room, in the field, in the analytic field. I think, yes, we try not to put our problems, our ideas, our opinions on the table when we're treating a patient, but our opinions come through anyway, and our feelings, what we're feeling with a patient, also comes through. So it's always a struggle, the abstinence. And I thought about it in terms of, for example, something that happened to me when I was a younger analyst. I had three pregnancies. When I was training to be an analyst, and then when I was an analyst, and that had my patients had very strong reactions to all three pregnancies. Now that was my need, my being, my body that was being put right there to be looked at and to be analyzed. So that's one form of putting yourself in the consulting room and putting yourself not abstinent, in mind, horn body, in with your patient. Now, with a book, with a memoir, I think it's different. I think it's different because it's a choice that one makes. I think one of my guiding lights was Winnicott, and I have one of his famous phrases, which I wrote down because I love it. It's, he says, Therapy is a sophisticated game of hide and seek, in which it is a joy to be hidden, but a disaster not to be found. And I thought about this while I was writing the memoir. I also thought of Margaret Little and of Gunthrop, who had written their memoirs about their analysis with Winnicott, because I studied Winnicott for many years, so I knew a lot about the middle group in Great Britain. And then I discovered relational analysis in New York. And suddenly a whole world opened up for me. It was in the early 2000, 2003, 2004, 2005. So I had permission, let's say. I had inner permission to write the memoir and to work through the contradictions and work through the difficulties that I might have and not have a Greek chorus in my head telling me, you can't do this. You cannot open yourself up this way. You cannot do this to your patients, your profession first. This might be your desire, but you cannot do this. So, you know, I finally, if you want to think about it in those terms, I had a desire to write this book, and my desire came first. And so in doing so, I became a subject for my patients. And that was something that I, not only an object and not only someone who was abstinent while I was with them, but someone whom they could know through this object that was the book I had written. Now, as I said before, it hasn't happened yet. It might happen.
Right. The experiment is yet to be run. Right. You use your father's last name as your last name. Do they know the meaning of your last name?
Not all of them, but most of them do. When I first came to Chile in 1980, most people didn't know who Norman Mailer was. Even in the memoir, I have a funny anecdote about going to group therapy workshop with two very well-known analysts, one who lived in Topeka and one who lived in Chile. Both of them were Chilean. The Chilean analyst asked us to talk about our parents, and I talked about our fathers, et cetera, and I started talking about my father, and I said, we have a complicated relationship. He's a famous man. He said, we all think our fathers are famous, and powerful. I said, no, but my father is famous, and he is a very powerful man. He said, what's his name? I said, Norman Mailer. He said, I've never heard of him. So I thought, what? He's never heard of my father? This is impossible. And then when they got together, the two analysts, probably the analyst from Topeka said to him, "What, you don't know who Norman Mailer is?" And he came up to me after the workshop was over and said, "So what is Norman Mailer's daughter doing in Chile?" So I think in a way it was a blessing.
That's sort of what I meant when I was referring to the reaction that people have when meeting you that I shared when I first met you.
Yes, and I had that reaction very much when I was in college at Barnard. And when I was in Barnard, I remember every person I met would say to me, "Oh, Mailer, as in Norman? Yeah, as in Norman. Oh, are you his daughter?" It was always the same thing. And I always had that, what you mentioned, I always had the kind of excitement and at the same time, oh, please, let's not go there right now. I want people to know me for who I am and not because of my name. But I don't think it was something that was totally, it was ambivalent. I think that's the perfect word.
Yeah, sure.
It was ambivalent.
It could only be. Your analytic journey, you've alluded to it by the various schools you were both trained in and then acquainted with, and now it sounds like immersed in. Can you tell us a little bit about what led you to be an analyst and then how it has dovetailed with your development as a writer?
I think I was an analyst. I was a psychologist, maybe you could say, from the time I was a little girl. As we all know, we become analysts to heal ourselves and to heal our parents. So I remember as a little girl, I was always very I always looked at people. I was always interested in their lives, always making up stories about people's lives, whom I met, or just passed walking down the street or in the car, and I would see other people, and I would think about, oh, I wonder what their lives are like. Or else I would be very careful to see what the moods of my parents were, especially my father. But I could always tell what somebody was feeling. And I think,
you know, there's an exchange in the book that jumped out at me early on. It was in the early part of your life when you described lying in bed and there was a hole in the ceiling. And that hole in the ceiling really upset you. And I'm reading from it now. You say, Daddy, I don't like that hole. Why don't you fix it? And he said, what bothers you about it? And it struck me, and but you then go on to say, but I couldn't really define my worries, and he never got around to fixing it. That was an atypical exchange, at least as represented in the memoir. He was really talking like an analyst. He said, talk about your feelings. What bothered you about it? And your presentation of him throughout the book otherwise is very much not like an analyst, but very telling you what you're feeling. Or not being interested in what you're feeling. That was my take on how you presented him as a person. But this was something different. He said, what bothers you about it? And I noted it and thought to myself, that can be an influence on somebody becoming an analyst.
Maybe, but it's something I wrote. I don't know if he actually said that, to tell you the truth. It's something that I remember him saying. And it might be... it might be the way I reconstruct that conversation. But I do remember him saying to me, asking me about the hole and what I didn't like about it. So, you know, it wasn't exactly those words. Mm-hmm. But I think that being a novelist, you know, having a father who's a novelist, a novelist, I think, has to get into the minds of other people. He has to go into his own mind and he has to have very deep fantasies, and he has to be able to understand the way people work. So I think on the one hand, I had a father who was a novelist, and that helped me understand or see or be curious. I think that's the word. Be curious about how, what makes people tick, how they think. And then my mother was a psychiatrist. So I think she was a great influence on my life and on my profession, my choice of profession.
And curiosity about people is certainly something that, whatever your theoretical allegiances, bottom line is it's curiosity and interest in people that, that has to motivate us.
Yes, absolutely. And I think it was my way. I loved, and I always have loved, listening to my patients and listening to their stories. And I think it was my way of being, it was my way of being a novelist, you know? Or my way of being in the arts, you could say, because I've always insisted that being an analyst or a therapist is a form of art, because it's very creative. You have to be creative. You can't just, it can't be by rote. It can't be by dictum. You can't do what other people tell you to do. It's something that flows from within you out. It has to do with knowledge, of course, and training and all that, everything we know. But it has a very large dosage of creativity. So I think I got that from my dad and my mother, both. Mm.
We have to touch a little bit on the country that you've lived in for all these years, Chile, because you lived there during the time of the dictatorship.
Yes.
And I've spoken to Argentinian analysts about what it was like under that regime. Can you share with us a little bit about both your own experiences and psychoanalysis in Chile during the dictatorship?
Sure, of course. And we could also talk about what's happening now in Chile, which is very interesting. I arrived here in Chile in 1980, so it was the dictatorship was in full bloom. It lasted for 17 years, and it so it was 9 years in. And there was a kind of it was quiet. I'm trying to figure out a way of saying there was a peacefulness in the country that was only on the surface, but there was rumbling. Here, Chile is a place that has a lot of earthquakes and very strong earthquakes, very big earthquakes. And so the earthquake was underneath, you know, it was waiting to come out, and you could feel it. You could feel it in the way people looked at each other, the way people interacted with each other. And it was the first time I'd ever been in a place where there was a dictatorship. So for me, it was a very powerful and difficult situation to be in. When I decided to become an analyst and call the Psychoanalytic Institute and apply to become an analyst, they told me when I finally was able to get in touch with them, because I couldn't find them, and I'm telling you this because this shows you a little bit of the way Chile was at the time. There was one psychoanalytic institute that had about 30 people, 30 analysts, and they had an address, they had a phone number that was given to me by an analyst that I met, and I called and called and called and never got an answer, and I went by the place and rang the bell and I never got an answer either, and then I found out that they only went there twice a week at night or three times a week at night. And they had a secretary that was there for like 4 hours a day. So it was like a mysterious place. You couldn't get in touch with them, you know? It was like this place that it was like a secret sect. I couldn't get in touch with them. Finally, I did. And they told me I had to revalidate my studies, that the Barner degree wasn't enough, that my psychology MA was not enough from Mexico, that I had to get a psychology degree from Chile, which took me another 5 years. Finally, I was able to apply, and I got in after all the interviews and everything. And there was always an unspoken threat in the air. You never spoke about Pinochet. You didn't talk about dictatorship. You didn't talk about the rights that were being violated. You only talked about psychoanalysis. And so there's a kind of dissociation that was very very strange, and it permeated everything we did. The way that we were taught, was very, by the way, very authoritarian, at least from my point of view. I might not have lived all my life in the United States, but I do have a kind of liberal, you know, coming from the parents I come from, going to Barnard and. Also Mexico, which is much freer than Chile, there was this kind of tightness and a kind of authoritarian quality about the way they taught us psychoanalysis. This is what you do, this is what you don't do. And it was mostly about all the things you shouldn't do.
Sure.
So I think that, of course, it had to do with the way that they taught classical analysis or what they thought classical analysis was. But it also had to do with the dictatorship and how it had permeated the society as well.
Just so I understand what you're saying, do you mean that your analyst sans could not talk about politics or would not talk about politics?
No, I'm not talking about the analyst sans. I'm talking about the training, the classes. Mm-hmm. It was during the classes, the cases that were presented. During the scientific meetings, the kinds of things that we talked about, we just didn't talk about what was going on in the country.
But in the office, you could?
Yes, of course. Yes, you could talk about that. And patients, by the way, chose their analyst according to their political leanings, okay? Yeah. So, and here in Chile, everybody knows everybody. So, I was anonymous here when I first got here. In the first 10 years I was here, I was pretty anonymous. So they didn't really know very much about me. And most of the patients that I got were looking for that. We're looking for someone who was not Chilean, who they didn't know where they came from, and wouldn't have the whole feel saturated, you know, by their beliefs. If you know what I mean. It's like,
yes.
if you get a leftist analyst, then you know that you can talk and you know that, but you also know that analyst will probably be thinking the same things you're thinking, and maybe you would like to have someone who is not thinking the same things you're thinking, but is not a writer, that kind of thing. So right. I had that advantage. And then in 1990, democracy returned to Chile, and it was a wonderful feeling because finally people were out in the streets. I mean, Chile was a place where at 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock, there was nobody outside. And the curfew was inside people. You know, people had incorporated the curfew. So even if the curfew was at 2 a.m., people weren't outside after 11. And they had parties from curfew to curfew, the young kids. Anyway, when the democracy came back, something just opened up in Chile, and it also opened up in the Psychoanalytic Association. More people applied, more young people applied. People were thinking in a different way. I mean, when I was training, people were scared to say what they thought. Hmm. Not about what was happening politically, but what they thought about what they read. You know, they were afraid to criticize Freud, or they were afraid to criticize Klein.
And their inhibitions weren't challenged, I gather.
No, it was unwritten law that you were not supposed to challenge these things. So when, for example, I would say, I don't agree with Klein. I mean, I can't believe that a newborn baby is going to have these feelings, et cetera, et cetera. You know, I would talk about Klein's ideas of the death instinct and the schizoid paranoid position, which I agreed with, the schizoid paranoid position, but not at the get-go. So I remember once one of my teachers said, you know, I think you have to analyze this a little bit more with your analyst. And I said, no, I don't. I am thinking about what I've read. So it was treated as a symptom, okay?
Well, that's the use of a pseudo-analytic model for purposes of oppression.
Exactly, exactly. So I would say that that's the way it seeped into the analytic society. And once democracy came back to Chile, as I said before, all these young people started applying and got in, and they were painters and actors, and they had other activities, and they were much more open. And also social media arrived in the country. So now you could Google your analyst, or you could question things. You could also the country went out of itself into the world. So now analysts were young analysts, and candidates were talking to candidates from other parts of the world, not only from Argentina, there's always been a very strong connection, but also from the United States, from Canada, from Colombia, from everywhere, from all over the world. And that was wonderful.
And how are things now?
Well, now there's been what they call a social explosion here in Chile. It started on the 18th of October. And it started with, there was a hike in the subway fare, just like 10 cents or 15 cents. But that was the grain of salt that just, or the grain of salt that just created the mm-hmm. mountain to come down. And people got very angry at this because for a few years, tension had been growing because of the inequality. Even though Chile is pretty well off, comparatively speaking, with other countries in Latin America, certainly from Argentina and other countries. But anyway, this anger turned into fury, and there was a week of fury here in Chile in which subway stations were looted, they were burnt, hotels, stores, pharmacies, banks. And it was, nobody really knew who was doing it. They looked like it was kids, but kids, I mean, by that I mean young people, like 16-year-olds, 18-year-olds. But we didn't know if it was, if they were anarchists, if they were drug dealers, or if it was just kids that were very angry, or if it was a combination of all that. And this upheaval, the social upheaval and unrest, has not stopped. I mean, it's much calmer now, but it is still going on. And this has come into the consulting room.
That's what I've wondered. Yeah.
Yeah. I've never seen something like this come into the consulting room in this way. All the patients talked about for weeks at a time was about what was going on in Chile and how unhappy they were, or how much hope they had, or they had hope for a new Chile, that Chile had awakened. Other people felt that Chile was going to collapse, that this was the end of Chile. People were horrified by the violence, by the looting, by the vandalism. Other people felt, no, this is what you have to do in order to have change. And so for all my colleagues, including myself, it was very hard to be abstinent and neutral.
Right. And this is a very parallel to what's happening in the country here in the States, where politics are very present in the consulting room, and notions of anonymity are really challenged. I have spoken to colleagues who said they deal with people's political sentiments as if they're dreams, that is strictly metaphorically, and other people just lay out how their own thoughts are, analysts, and you can't guess by their conservatives, quote unquote, conservative stance, who is taking what position. People are doing all kinds of different things when pressed by the powerful feelings that everybody has about what's happening politically, both here and apparently in Chile as well.
Yes. And I would say, Harvey, that for me, this has been more difficult than the memoir.
I can imagine.
Because I have my own ideas, and a lot of my ideas do not agree with some of my patients or some of my colleagues, for example.
Right.
And it's been very difficult to, even with colleagues, to be able to have a conversation that doesn't end up with a fight, or with patients not interjecting my ideas, because the upheaval is inside me as well. It's not only in the patients.
I understand that.
So this has been very stressful. It's been stressful for everybody.
And our field has yet to really embrace the implications of this. There's very little written about the different approaches that different analysts take. Some analysts feel so powerfully about politically what's happening here that they lay it out, and hopefully they give room for patients to explore their own imaginings, and other people choose not to. And it would be nice if we could discuss the outcomes of these experiments, like the outcome of your experiment with your memoir.
Yes.
There's so much more I'd like to talk to you about, Susan, but we've sort of run out of time. You've really you've demonstrated how much vibrancy you bring to this, and enjoying your memoir so much, and learning about your family, and certainly about your father, as seen through your eyes. Your vibrancy reminds me of the image you have of him. It's comes across very nuanced and very analytic and very self-aware, but there's a gusto to you that would certainly apply to your father as well. And it's been a pleasure for me to read the memoir, and also to get to know you and your work. And I'm grateful for your joining us.
It's been very pleasurable to talk to you. And I'm very happy to hear that, by the way. I'm happy to hear that my gusto reminds you of his gusto, or the other way around.
Absolutely. Right.
That makes me happy. Yeah.
Good.
Okay, well.
Thanks so much.
Okay, good night.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.